Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians, friends and neighbors. Thank you, as always, for joining us. We always like to say nice things about our super producer, Casey Pegram. And we do mean these sincerely, but we have a special announcement today, one that blew my mind, actually. Another thing to add to the long legend of Casey's shadow here. This guy came in to record today's episode on his actual birthday.
It's true. I'm here, and it is my birthday.
What a guy. My name is Noel. Are you still Ben? You're Ben, right?
I am several times over Ben Bolin, yes. And this is the first time that we have that the three of us have been in the studio together in a little while. Shouts out also to Christopher Hasiotis for pinch hitting there. I checked out that episode. That was pretty cool, man.
Oh, thanks, man. I enjoyed it. Christopher is a real mensch for pinch hitting while you were off on adventures. And I alluded a little bit to your adventures, but I didn't want to spill the tea, as it were, as the kids would say. Ed, what were you doing, Ben?
I was doing all sorts of non-sketchy things. I traveled to Japan, to a couple of different towns in Japan. One was Nagoya, one was Tokyo, and I was able to make it back. I have a couple of cool stories about it, but they may be maybe stories for another day, or if we want to knock off early this afternoon, maybe we can grab a beer and regale each other, because I got to tell you, man, I'm coming in hot. My body doesn't know what time it is. My body has a vague spider sense about what day it is. So luckily, this is our favorite history show, so we don't have to talk about today. And I don't think we have to talk about specific times on the clock, but we do have to talk about badasses.
We absolutely do. Ben, how do you like your saints? I like mine murderous.
I like my saints the way I like my superheroes. So saints often, at least in Catholicism, are patrons of one thing or another. So I like very specific patronages for saints. And I also like, I'm going to tell you, I like some Song of Ice and Fire, some Game of Thronesy historical gore when it comes to saints.
Well, I'm going to drop a couple of superlatives here, and I want you folks out in podcast land to use your imagination, picture what kind of individual might be attached to these. The missionary to Ukraine. Okay, that doesn't sound so exciting. Well, how about the Viking Saint Queen of Russia? Or my personal favorite, the Scourge of the Drevlians.
Also known as Equal to the Apostles. These are all titles held by Princess Olga of Kiev, now Saint Olga of Kiev. And I love that. I love that string of honorifics, too. It's very Daenerys Targaryen. It's very, for the nerds in the crowd, it's very Viggo of Carpathia.
It's very Xena Princess Warrior. Mm-hmm. Warrior Princess?
Xena Warrior Princess.
Boom.
And just to be clear, that's Viggo the Carpathian.
His name is Viggo.
Wife to you and mother to me.
Exactly.
Oh, you know what it bears up on a rewatch? So Saint Olga, unlike Viggo, is a real person. And she was born in a city in what is today northwestern Russia, close to the Estonian border. The city's name is going to be great fodder for all of us on Ridiculous Historians. It is spelled P-S-K-O-V. So what do you think? Pskov?
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 Yeah. I don't know. We're probably going to have a lot of fun with a lot of these pronunciations on today's episode. If there are any people with Estonian heritage out there, please feel free to write in and shred us new ones for our pronunciation. We will do our level best. What do you think? Should we go with Skov? Silent P?
I like the psk.
Pskov.
For the reason that it's more fun in my mouth.
Do you know what Visco girls are, Ben?
What are Visco girls?
Visco girls, it's a sort of a meme thing. My 10-year-old told me about it. They are sort of basic, you know, quote unquote. Uh-huh. So they have a particular garb, and it's scrunchies around their wrists, short shorts, clean white Van slip-ons, some sort of long baggy t-shirt, and they always have a water bottle with bright colored stickers on it that is the brand Hydro Flask, and they laugh like this.
I think you told me about this at some point.
So Piskoff kind of sounds like the way Visco girls laugh is what I'm getting at.
There we go. There we go.
And, got there.
And their name is probably based on the storied history of this area.
It's got to be based on that plugin, right?
It's an app, yeah. It's a photo editing app for Instagram.
Casey on the case. Let's go back to those names. Viking, Saint, Queen, missionary to Ukraine, equal to the apostles.
Mother of dragons.
Mother of dragons, breaker of chains, scourge of the Drevlians. The thing about Princess Olga is that she earned all of these titles. And today's story is about how she got there, about how she went from being a princess. And being a princess is a problematic, beautiful thing. You know, a lot of people love the stories of royalty, but unfortunately, many, many princes and princesses end up being historical footnotes. Why is Olga different?
Right, because you think of a princess, you think of a fair maiden, helpless and defenseless, being kept somewhere in a tower, you know, relegated to her room behind lock and key. This was not the case for Olga. In 912, she married a man by the name of Igor? What do
Igor,
you say?
Igor.
There, so you know that for a fact because you've got Russian pals. And Igor was the heir to the throne of Kiev. Ben, can you tell us a little bit about the geography of Kiev?
Luckily, I can. Kiev, now a city in Ukraine, it's part of something we call the Kievan Rus, R-U-S apostrophe. Kievan Rus was a federation of Finnish and East Slavic people in Europe from, let's say, around the 9th century to somewhere in the 13th century. But this name was a retronym. It was not called Kievan Rus at the time. This is a name that we sort of made up later as a species. And when we say a loose federation, we have to be very mindful to realize that This is a somewhat common thing historically in a lot of places. Just the problem of communication makes it difficult for a large, uniform lockdown empire to exist.
And wouldn't this have been sort of almost something bordering on tribal, kind of? Like you had chieftains rather than elected officials?
Sure. Yeah. So we see the traces of Rus in the modern day because nations like Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus all sort of claim Kievan Rus as their cultural DNA. You know, obviously Belarus, Russia have the name Rus in their own country's name. The name Kievan Rus comes to us around somewhere in like the 1800s, 19th century or so, but it has the same meaning as the land of the Rus, which is how it was called in the Middle Ages and during Olga's time. The first stories about the Rus from the time that people historically arrive in this region is told in the Primary Chronicle, which is also known as the Tale of Bygone Years, the Russian Primary Chronicle. And this is where we get a lot of the information about Princess Olga and her hubs, Igor himself.
That's right. Igor was a Viking descendant. His father, a man by the name of Rurik, was a chieftain. Like we said, this was a very kind of tribal society, and his people were called the Varangians. I don't know about that pronunciation. What
cool
do you think?
Name.
It reminds me of the Ferengis from Star Trek a little bit.
Yeah.
Or
the Varivags, they were also called. V-A-R-Y-A-G-S. Varyags. There we go.
And so he actually made the seat of his empire, or his, you know, power stronghold at somewhere called Novgorod, which was on the Volkhov River. So in 879, Rurik passed away, and he gave all of this land that he held to his pal Oleg, because Igor was just a little too young to rule, and so he was basically, you could call this like sort of like an early form of a trust. He was holding on to this land and this title until Igor became of age.
Right, so Rurik essentially said, I love my kid, Igor. He's stand-up AF, but he is just too much of a whippersnapper right now. So Oleg and Igor moved the capital of the Rus to Kiev, and they found the kingdom of the Kievan Rus. This would, this is the origin point of Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and so on. And at its largest, imagine it stretching from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. So from sea to shining sea. Igor grows up. He manages not to die, and in 913, he takes the throne. Again, this comes to us from the Primary Chronicle. As you had said earlier, Noel, this is a very tribal, socio-political time, right? So there, you're always playing King of the Hill, and you're always trying to fight the next guy or group coming up. So as soon as Igor gets the throne in 913, he has to put down a rebellion, because one of their client states or one of their client communities, the Drevlyans, decided, you know what? When Rurik was in play, we understood the game, but Igor, you're new. You're brand new to this. We don't have to respect you. We don't have to pay you a tax or a tribute. Igor, forced to the point, says, okay, I'll call your bluff. And he fights them and subdues them. This leads to a reign of peace until 945. At which point, the same tribe rebels again.
That's right. So Igor had to take care of this second Drevlyan rebellion. And in order to do that, he actually had to leave Kiev and go to where the fighting was. He succeeded in quashing this rebellion once again. And he said, look, you guys are really testing me, so I'm going to have some real consequences aside from, massacring their people, which would be higher tributes. You could equate it to making them pay more taxes, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm. And he said, he pulled a DJ Khaled because he was on his way home, but he stopped and he said, another one. He sent the majority of his forces back to home base with the tribute, and then he came back to the Drevlyans with a smaller force, and this really weirded out the rebellious tribe.
It's a little weird.
Yeah. So they said, okay, let's not let them physically get all the way to our town. Let's send out some emissaries and say, dude, what is going on with you? And then Igor says, I refuse to comment. So they panic and they send out a force. They send out an army. They subdue Igor's forces and they capture him. They take him to a place just outside their city and they tie two birch trees to his legs.
Bent, they're like bent down to the ground. I guess those are very flexible trees. I'm not sure exactly how they would do it. Maybe tying a rope to the top and pulling it down so the tippy top touches the ground.
And then probably tying it to the trunk.
Right.
To make like a U shape, upside down U shape.
And then they let them loose, each one of them. And you can probably figure out what might have happened there. A very unpleasant form of the splits that, split all the way down, from stem to stern. Dude was essentially torn in twain.
Mm-hmm. A Byzantine chronicler named Leo the Deacon, upon whom a lot of the Russian Primary Chronicle is based, this Byzantine writer said that they literally tore the guy's body apart when these birch trees straightened. And now we're in a situation where history may not repeat, but it does rhyme. The king is dead. The king's heir, in this case, a three-year-old named Sviatoslav, is too young to take the throne, just the way that Igor was too young to take the throne when his father, Rurik, died. However, the situation is different here because you'll recall that Igor married the subject of today's episode, Princess Olga of Kiev, and Noel, what does she do?
Lots of stuff. I have a quick question, though. Quick diversion. Just want to ask you. Why do you think he doubled back? Why do you think Igor doubled back and sent his men home?
He didn't say.
He didn't say.
We'll never know.
Bizarre.
We'll never know.
Weird move.
Maybe he forgot his keys.
He already won.
Maybe he was hungry. Maybe he needed to use the restroom. You know, I don't know much about Kievan ruler's choice of washroom facilities. So I assumed at this point in history, people just went off a decent distance into the woods. But
you would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I find that interesting. And I also find it interesting that he mocked them essentially and said, I'm not going to tell you why I came back. It's a very odd turn of events that ultimately led to this guy dying in a very brutal and horrific way.
There's definitely more to this story. And, you know, history is written by the winners. So it is possible, maybe, that they asked him to come back or he felt he had to for some reason. I mean, obviously he felt like he had to. But when Olga learns this information, she's hit with a lot of stuff at once, right?
She sure was, Ben. I mean, here's the thing. These Drevians?
Yeah, we've seen it spelled a couple different ways. Drevlians, Drevlyans, or Drevians.
That's right. They thought that they had the upper hand here, right? Because they figured, oh, she's just a— Like I said, that misperception or stereotypical perception of what a princess is, she's some kind of demure aristocrat who they can just boss around. Now there's a woman in charge, quote unquote, that they can use to kind of do whatever they want with. They're basically thinking this is a strategic victory for them as a people, that maybe they can get the upper hand and force her to marry one of theirs.
Prince Mal.
Prince Mal. That's right. That would make it so they didn't have to pay these taxes anymore, these tributes, and also potentially make it where they were by default ruling the region, ruling the roost.
Right.
The Kievan Rus.
Right. We do have to remember that the idea of marrying for love and for for personal, individual, romantic feelings is, you know, it's not as common. Back in the day, right? So it makes more sense. It's kind of a standard operating procedure for communities to attempt to align one another through strategic marriage, thus also upping their own street cred, right, in this region. They send 20 of their top-notch guys, probably Prince Mal's favorite personal reps, to persuade Princess Olga to marry the guy who was in charge of her former husband's murderers. Again, this sounds crazy, but it is not super unusual in these times. Princess Olga plays into this sort of shrinking violet assumptions that these people have about her. She welcomes them into her house.
Yeah, treats them like official, you know, guests of the state.
Mm-hmm. She does the version of rolling out the red carpet, wherein she orders her forces to carry the men in their boats so they don't have to even walk themselves.
As if they were some sort of like palanquin or like a litter or something like that, right? Really giving them the royal treatment. But she had something else in mind, didn't she?
Right. So they take these boats, her people take these boats to the courtyard of the castle. There is a giant trench that has been pre-dug, and they put the boats with the men in them into the trench. Maybe this is just, you know, maybe it's just a weird party, they might be thinking. But what happens next?
Yeah, I kind of feel like they probably would have, some of them would have been mortally injured already in that situation. If you're in a wooden boat and you just get chucked into a pit, you know, maybe you land upside down on your neck or something like that and get a mortal injury. But that wasn't going to be enough. These people were already obviously very uncomfortable, whatever the case might be, whether they died or not. And she had them all buried alive. And this had to have been a serious pit. Right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it would have taken a long time to fill in. There would have had to have been no way for them to claw their way out, or it would have been very difficult. I'm trying to picture the scene, and it reminds me of something you might have seen in, like, Caligula.
Sure, yeah. And here's the thing, though. The flaw in this plan, as I'm sure many of the more Machiavellian of us listening can immediately identify, is that there's no one alive to send word back to Prince Mal and co.
Yeah.
So she has anticipated this. Olga has not only anticipated this, but she is taking it to a further extreme. She picks one of her emissaries to send word back to Prince Mal and says, you know what? Water under the bridge, Broheim. I accept your proposal for this marriage stuff. Caveat, asterisk, I'll only accept if the Drevians send part of their company, like a big piece of their army, to be my escort back to your neck of the woods.
Seems legit. Maybe would have been a little suspicious that their 20 men had not returned yet.
Yeah, maybe they were just being feted and fed and entertained. And she has some logic here for the prince. She says, after all, you know, we want everybody in the land to see what a big deal this is, right? So send me to you in style. Don't I deserve it? And what does Prince Mal do? Yeah, he seems pretty into it.
Sure did. He complied instantly and sent some of his top chieftains to escort her.
Yeah. And they show up, right?
Yeah, and they were met with another rolling out of the red carpet, as it were. And she says, hey, guys, you're clearly very dusty from your journey. Why don't you come into one of our famed bathhouses and have yourself a schwitz? You ever heard that, a schwitz?
I've heard it. I don't know if that's what she said, but I totally get the gist.
Yeah, they say it on The Sopranos a lot. It's when you go in and have like a steam bath. It's a schwitz. I like it. But yeah, so they're in there thinking they're going to have a nice little soak, possibly a steam bath, whatever they got. And she locks the doors behind them.
And she burns everyone in that bathhouse alive.
Yep.
The building collapses. Like, she kills another group of people. And so now you think, okay, let's just sort of assume Prince Mal's perspective here. He's got to know something's up at this point. After all, a good portion of his army, his martial forces, has been buried alive. The chieftains, the ruling class, his personal picks, his selects, have also been burned alive.
Presumably he doesn't know any of this, though.
Right, right.
He just knows they have not returned.
Right. So you have to at least be thinking about the first group. Kind of weird that none of those guys got back. So Olga is not done yet. She says it's not enough to kill his top-notch army folks. It's not enough to kill essentially the ruling class of this tribe. I want to get rid of all of them. So she says something along the lines of like, my dear fiancé, I will soon be arriving at the Drevian capital of Iskoristan and asking them to arrange a funeral feast where we can mourn over the death of my husband Igor in the city.
Yeah, and that perspective comes from an article on historyanswers.co.uk in the article, Olga of Kiev, one saint you do not want to mess with. That is completely accurate. So dude is still, Mal, still very, very much in the dark about what's happened to his men. He gets this message, which goes on, that she wishes for him and his men to prepare vast quantities of mead, which is like a fermented honey beer kind of situation you may well remember from Beowulf. You ever had mead before, Ben?
Yeah, multiple times.
What's it taste like?
It's cool. You can definitely taste the honey notes. And usually mead's not a regular weekly or monthly thing for me, but usually you run into it at some really cool cultural events. There are a bunch in Atlanta. I would love to take you guys at some point.
Do you think they have it at medieval times?
They probably have something they call mead.
Right.
It might be Bud Light or Miller Light, the beer that's so good you can drink it with your mouth.
Do they make Mead Light, do you think?
Maybe they call it like Mead Zero.
There you go. I like it.
Anyhow.
So she says, please, you must prepare these vast quantities of mead, quote, that I may weep over the grave of my husband and hold a funeral feast for him.
And Mal's like, word, I get it. You know, she's keeping it real. You've got to have these sort of closures in life.
Yeah, and she's being, you know, very reasonable about all this, you know?
In these, our crazy times, what can we be except for human? So he says totally, and gives Olga and her crew, her entourage, safe passage into the territory, into the town. And once she arrives, she holds this huge opulent being a comparative term, opulent funeral for Igor, who has passed. A lot of people show up, a lot of the townsfolk, a lot of the important individuals of the time. This is a see and be seen sort of thing, kind of the way that the Infinity Mirrors exhibit at the High Museum was. However, maybe they trusted Olga a little bit too much. Maybe they should have thought a little more carefully about the context, because they totally chillax. They rage. They get wasted. They're super drunk. But Olga, it turns out, and the forces that she brought with her are not drunk.
Yeah, I don't know if they were play acting and, you know, doing that thing where someone buys you a shot and you've had enough and you don't want to be rude, so maybe you just kind of do a pretend sip and then, you know, hide it. Maybe there was some of that going on. I don't know. Maybe no one else but me does that. But they definitely got away without being noticed that they weren't drinking, because that would be very suspicious, right?
Yep. They got away with it. They waited until the Drevyans were drunk, and then Olga said, okay, kill them. According to the Russian Primary Chronicle, around 5,000 Drevlins died that day, or Drevyans.
It would have been an absolute slaughter, some real red wedding stuff.
But wait, as Billy Moyes was wont to say, there's more.
Yeah, there's more. It's what you might consider her coup de grace, her finale, her big finish, act four of this revenge chronicle. Because this wasn't enough for her. She wanted more. She really wanted to wipe out all of those that had anything to do with the death of her beloved husband. So, you know, there obviously were some survivors. 5,000 seems like a lot, because this wouldn't have been a population of millions. I mean, again, these were kind of smaller clans, right?
That's correct. Yeah, this was not a huge metropolis the way we would understand one today. So the surviving Drevyans, they were super freaked out, essentially. And they begged and begged and begged, please don't kill us. We will pay with whatever we have. We can't give you an army to serve you yet. Give us a few generations. Here's what we have. We have honey. We have furs. Please take these. Leave us with our lives. At this point, Olga says, you know what? Maybe this time I'll be cool. Give me 3 pigeons and 3 sparrows from each of your houses. And she says, I don't want to impose a heavy tribute like my husband Igor, because I know this siege and all these terrible things that I've done to you have left you in a really bad spot. So yeah, just give me 3 pigeons, 3 sparrows from each of your houses.
Not sketchy at all. And I got to say, this sounds like the stuff of legend. I have a hard time believing this happened in this exact way, but this is what the Chronicle tells us. So I'm willing to suspend disbelief for the time being, but this is genius. So she takes these birds, these pigeons and sparrows, and she has each one of her militiamen, her soldiers, take one and attach a string to their little bird feet. And in that string, there would be a piece of sulfur, which is tied up in a small piece of cloth. And then as the sun goes down, Olga tells her men to release these creepy birds all at once. And we should mention, you didn't think it was a little weird, maybe, listeners, that everyone just happened to have these birds? Well, it was a thing. They were like pets or kind of familiars. Like, it was very much they would, you know, occupy people's houses.
Well, they also would make eggs.
Right.
So there's a source of food there. Yeah, and they lived in different parts of houses, right? So the birds fly to their various nests. The pigeons fly to the cotes, and cotes are a shelter for mammals or birds, especially pigeons. Like Mike Tyson, a notorious pigeon lover, amongst other things, he has pigeon cotes. And then the sparrows fly under the eaves where they tend to build their nests so they can stay away from the rain.
Then you had porches, I guess, which is just, you know, the front of a person's house. And then you had haymows, which were just stacks of hay in barn situations.
And that's when the dovecotes, the coops, the porches, the eaves, the piles of hay all catch a blaze. According to the Chronicle, there is not a house that escapes this conflagration. And because the houses all caught fire at roughly the same amount of time, it was difficult to extinguish everything. People fled from the city. And then Olga, who had her eye on it, said, oh, no, 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 no. Catch those folks running for the woods.
Dude, this is like the tiny bat bombs. Remember the bat bombs?
Mm-hmm.
In Japan. The idea was that they would roost in the eaves in the in all these houses all at the same time, and then the bombs would go off. That didn't work so well. This seems to have worked better than the bat bombs. If you guys want to check that episode out, this might be a fun companion piece. And like you said, yeah, those little bits of sulfur ignited all of these very, very flammable nesting spots, and boom. The whole town went up like flash paper, and the few who escaped were running into the woods. What happened next?
So here's the heavy metal part of this. This is where things build the same way that one of my favorite songs, In the Hall of the Mountain King, builds. It just gets more and more nuts, because while this city is burning down, Princess Olga of Kiev orders her forces to take it, and they capture the surviving elders of the city. She kills some of them, and then others she gives to her crew to serve as slaves for the rest of their lives. And then the ones left, she says, remember me and pay tribute. This is insane. We also know that she did more than this. So this is like one amazing revenge story, right? But it's not really the end of her story, because she was still regent for a long time before her son ascended to the throne. And at this point, this is where a lot of us are probably asking ourselves, hey, the title equal to the apostles sounds kind of weird for someone who is best known, at least according to you, Ben, and you, Noel, as a bloody revenge artist. The thing is that she turned a religious leaf about a decade after her revenge against Prince Mal and her husband's murderers.
Because these folks would have practiced paganism, I guess, to use kind of a blanket term, right?
Well, they were definitely, yeah, Christians would definitely call them pagans, and Christianity was not seen as a beneficial force to the Kievan Rus. But Olga visited Constantinople, and she met Christians there, and whatever the substance of their conversation may have been, it impressed her, and soon after, she converted. This was weird because her own country, Kievan Rus, hated Christianity, hated the culture of it, hated the spirituality of it. They just, from top to bottom, they thought it sucked.
Well, Christianity was a conquering force. I mean, there was a real drive to snuff out any pagan societies and convert them to Christianity. So for her, this warrior queen to convert voluntarily is more than a little suspicious, if you ask me, but who knows?
Well, yeah, the Chronicle claims to know, because in the Chronicle, the authors say that Olga's conversion, or her epiphany that turns her into a Christian, was part of a ruse.
A Kievan ruse?
Right, a Kievan ruse. In this case, R-U-S-E, to avoid marriage to the emperor at the time, Constantine the VII. Because when she visited his court in Constantinople, she said they could not possibly marry because he was a Christian and she was a pagan, but she would undergo baptism if it pleased him. So she was baptized by the Patriarch of Constantinople, and she managed to evade marriage to Constantine because he stood by as her godfather during the baptism.
It's a pretty serious godfather right there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So why is she known as a saint? Well, she knew when violence worked, and she apparently also knew when the strategy of the open hand worked. She began missionary efforts in modern-day Ukraine. She set up hospitals, and she used public announcements to teach people about the Christian faith. Everything that we know about missionary work tends to indicate that people are more likely to believe in the religion you are pitching to them if they associate it with good things happening to them, right? So if someone sets up a hospital for you or feeds the poor and the hungry and then says, by the way, I'm doing this because of this religion, you are more likely to agree with them than you would if they said, oh, by the way, we killed everyone important in your community
right,
because our religion is so great.
Yeah, catching more flies with honey and all that. So indeed, it took a little while, but the kingdom of Kievan Rus did eventually become a Christian one. It took about 10 years after Olga's death. She also was, of course, given a Christian burial, that her son Vladimir took the throne of Kiev, what is now Kiev, and made Christianity the official religion. And again, remember, this is, Constantinople would have been sending out emissaries and folks that were going to try to convert the unwashed pagan masses of Kievan Rus to Christianity. But she succeeded where those folks failed. And that is what got her that sainthood.
And thus, we finally arrive at the reason Princess Olga of Kiev is now known as Saint Olga of Kiev, equal to the apostles, Viking Saint Queen of Russia, missionary to Ukraine, scourge of the Drevlins. What a ride.
Seriously.
What a ride.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it occurs to me, I'm like, people are out here changing the world, and I fell asleep when I got back from the airport trying to put on a pair of pants.
Well, you were very jet-lagged, and I'm sure you had adventures that kept you up, so we give you a pass on that, Ben. That is a real image, though, I'll tell you.
Yeah,
it's very good. Was it one leg in, or?
You know, when I woke up, I would give myself a hard 1.5 in putting on the pants in terms of leg applied.
Got it.
I think my left leg made it about to where the knee would be, and then it was game over. You know, you can't win them all. I got pants on today at least, so one step closer to sainthood, eh?
I can attest that, and it is also game over for this episode, but not the show, as you would say, Ben. This has been a really interesting one. I would love to see this made into a rollicking film.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's got all the stuff.
I would watch it too as maybe one of those extended music videos. I'm really into that. It would be a great anime too. Although my thinking is probably a little colored in
that
regard.
That's probably true. Probably true.
Thank you so much for checking out the show. As always, Happy New Year once again to super producer Casey Pegram. Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis. Thanks to our research associates, Gabe Luzier and Ryan Barish.
Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Thanks to Jonathan Strickland, the notorious Quister, for not showing up today. That's always a good day in the studio. And thanks to you, Ben, for being a friend and for making it back and for getting your pants on and looking shipshape despite your sleeplessness and jet laggery.
Thanks to you as well, Noel. Peek behind the curtain. We have one more episode to record, so I am going to go shotgun some coffee.
Sounds like a plan. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.